Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Bald Move Prestige, where we've got a great film today, but it might have a couple of you people scratching your head about why it's in the Prestige release. It's 1982's First Blood, which is indeed an action film, but we'll get to our defense here in a minute. It's directed by Ted Kotcheff, who, if you were like me, was like, literally who? He also directed Uncommon Valor, a war film starring Gene Hackman, and a bunch of comedies like Weekend at Bernie's.
This movie is a lot like Weekend at Bernie's. A lot.
It is exactly like Weekend at Bernie's, which is why it's, of course, Prestige. It's a screenplay written. Now, this is just a partial list. Michael Kozel, William Sackheim, and Sly Stallone, who had the final revision, as the legend has. But there were like 18 different revisions. It's based on the novel First Blood by David Morrell, and it's got music by the prolific Jerry Goldsmith. I actually thought the soundtrack was really, really good. It's got the we might have a disagreement.
90% of the soundtrack is great.
Okay, the credit song.
Oh my god, dude, we'll talk about it. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if he's responsible for that, because the actual score to dun 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. You know, it was good for the action scenes. And he also has some kind of heartstring pulling music, too, that really makes the film work in the moments that it needs to. It stars Sylvester Stallone as John Rambo, a tortured Vietnam vet trying to make his way back home. Richard Crenna, who plays the Colonel Troutman. Character who is the Dr. Frankenstein to Sly Stallone's monster. And Brian Dennehy is another type of monster, a small time cop that can't stand drifters and vagrants. And he's got it in for this Medal of Honor winner, John Rambo, and also a teeny tiny baby, David Caruso.
Yeah.
Might just be a newly minted David Caruso. I didn't actually look, but he's got a fairly big part in the early goings of this movie. And, you know, he sticks out like emergency flare as soon as he shows up on the screen.
He really does. I didn't realize how red his hair was, maybe because I've seen him later in life. But, oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, here's the thing. If you think Rambo, Prestige, what are you guys smoking? Let me tell you, because I used to think that same way. I grew up playing Rambo video games, seeing the Rambo cartoon. I wasn't allowed to see the actual movies, but I knew enough from my cousins and pop culture to know it's just big, roided up Stallone mowing down hundreds of dudes, exploding arrows, off in Afghanistan, fighting Russians, and just this over-the-top crazy action. And I don't know if we saw this at the same time. Like, this is one of the things when we were going through action movie kick.
But I know we watched it together at some point. Yeah.
Okay. And maybe it was like I told you, like, we should watch Rambo or The First Blood. And you're like, it's stupid. And I'm like, no, serious. Because, like, when I first saw this film, I was ready for some dumb, stupid Arnold Sylvester action movie commando type of thing. And I just couldn't believe how good this film was.
Yeah.
Like, yes, it has action, but it's fairly grounded and it's all character driven. And the central figure of Rambo has got so much pathos.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final scene is like legitimately devastating. The pain that this guy's enduring. I think it's a great film, and I think it works for a lot of different reasons. It's kind of like this thing that accidentally came together, it sounds like. What did you think of the film? And what do you think of it now?
Yeah, I have the same opinion you do on it. I was so thoroughly impressed by this movie, going into it expecting it to be Rambo 2, Rambo 3. This is a whole different beast. This feels like a series that has kind of perverted the original intent of the Rambo series and mm-hmm. just turned it into an action, over-the-top action movie. But this first movie is surprisingly poignant. And I read like Roger Ebert's review of the thing, and it was contemporary. It was 1982. And he seemed to think that you have to remember, Roger Ebert is a guy who's, even at that point, had seen a lot of films, right? And a lot of really high profile and prestigious films. And so when he, you know, calls back to other films that have done this same sort of moment at the end with the big speech and the you know, emotional breakdown that the character has to have over going to Vietnam and coming back, you know, broken and unwanted, essentially, with nothing. He's seen three other movies that do that at least. I hadn't. And so when I saw this movie, it kind of blew me away. And, it, you know, it's like the ending is Sylvester Stallone being Sylvester Stallone in some ways, like, you can barely understand what he's saying half the time. But the stuff that does come across is enough for me to just go, wow, this movie has some depth to it. And it starts off that way, too. It's sort of bookended with those two things. And in between is what I think is a really incredibly paced action film.
Oh, my God. And yes,
this movie has basically two halves, right? Well, I mean, it's obviously got three acts, but the two action parts of it are especially the first one, the battle in the forest. That's just an amazing action piece all around. And then, you know, it gets a little muddier when they get to the town at the end. But even that keeps you engaged the entire time. And this movie is only an hour and a half long. This is an easy watch, and it brings a lot of heart. It brings a lot of pathos. It brings a lot of really great action. I love this film.
And I think it's amazing. And I didn't realize this. So I started reading some contemporary views of it but it tracked one kill in this movie, one death, and it's an accidental one. It's pretty incredible. And like, I think that's the thing is if you tell that to people, like it just completely blows their mind that this is actually a Rambo film. And it's similar to, like, you know, Rocky, who's, you know, Stallone wrote and won Oscars for. I think he's got the gift of like the Boyd Crowder character. Who's the guy that plays Boyd Crowder?
Walter Goggins.
I'm blanking. Walter Goggins.
Walton Goggins.
Walton Goggins is very good at playing smart characters that by circumstances of the birth give them a speech impediment that allows them that doesn't allow them to be taken seriously. You know, if you've got the mind of Einstein, but you talk like you just walked out of a coal mine in Appalachia, 90% of people in America are going to write you off. If you have like this agile, intelligent, quick mind, but you were born in like, you know, the wrong side of the tracks in Philly, or in the Bronx, same difference. And I think that's like that kind of little bit of the Yo Adrian that comes out of this film gives you, but everything else in this film gives you this idea that this guy is just a force to be reckoned with. And you can't be like, he's not a meathead, you know, he's careful. He's a planner. He's very tactical and strategic. And also, like, the other thing they do is they make, I think, both sides sympathetic. I think they could have done a little bit better of a job with Brian Dennehy's character, because there's a lot of stuff in the novel and maybe in the gargantuan 3.5 hour cut that this film first, you know, the first draft of it that was in there, and they kept cutting and cutting and cutting. But the other thing about Sly is that, man, I watched a couple interviews of him talking about this, and he always comes across when he's talking about film and incredibly smart. And one of his insights into this film is, like, I guess, like, one of the alpha versions of this film was loaded with kind of contemporary one liners and zingers, where he was like, you know, at one point in this the cut, he killed an owl and said, "Eat that, you mouse eating motherfucker." And there's like lots of
wow.
And when he saw this, it was such, he said he felt, he actually, I guess when he first saw the full clip or the full cut, he wanted to buy the negatives and burn it because he thought this was going to ruin his career.
Yeah.
But sitting and kind of, you know, working on the post, working on the edits and scripts, the idea was like, just cut all of his dialogue. And so that, like, when you get to the end, you're bookended by his awkward performance with the mother of a person he served with in Vietnam, and then his emotional breakdown with the one man maybe in the whole world that he still trusts. That's what sticks out in your mind. And it's such a, it was such a smart instinct to pair, like, the pull a lean, mean, Sly Stallone-esque 90 minutes out of this 3.5 hour disaster. And it just works so well. And every single time, every single time I watch it, I appreciate a little bit more of the details and the characterizations and stuff. For example, for the first time, I was watching him talking to the mother of the guy that didn't, you know, made it back from Vietnam, but died of cancer, Agent Orange and all that. They allude to that.
Yeah.
And he talks as he's talking to his mom and trying to get her to warm up to him. He's like, yeah, look, you know, here's me and here's the other, all the other guys in Baker Squad. And here's this guy. Of course, we had to put him in the back because he's so big. You know, if we put him in front, he'd. And, you know, a minute later, she's talking about how he wasted away. And she's like, at the end, I didn't even need help to lift him, you know, by a sheet out of his bed. Like, it just like without even telling you, talk about like when he's later says cancer eats, ate him to the bone. It's like just really smart stuff like that in the script. I thought was just really remarkable how efficiently they get this information across without you even really realizing it.
Yeah. Super economical storytelling. And it doesn't seem like it was that way to begin with. But like what they got this down to, this is a film that was saved in the edit, like Star Wars, like The Godfather, like all of these great films. This is another one of those. And
like the Zack Snyder cut.
Right. Right. We need more. We need more Rambo. Can Zack Snyder get in there? But yeah, they cut down so much, but you get everything you need, right? I understand he's a POW. He was tortured. He never broke under that torture. And so when Troutman comes in and starts talking, you know, like these police are completely fucked and they're fighting against essentially a country's worth of army in one man.
Mm-hmm.
You believe it, right? You see what he's already been through, but they don't spend much time on it. They spend maybe 30 seconds in flashbacks showing us his torture scenes.
Yeah. And in all in like context of like, you know, he's in a jail cell and he's being, you know, manhandled and sprayed with the hoses and all this other shit that goes down probably in small town lockups. And it's all just triggering the fuck out of him because he remembers apparently being in a POW camp and being mistreated by the Viet Cong. And it's and again, Stallone, when he's not full on Yo Adrian mode, has this kind of like. When he's just like neutral face, there's something kind of both noble and sad about him.
Yeah.
Like he's got this resting kind of like, I've used this word, I think three times already, pathos.
Mm-hmm.
That it's hard to imagine anyone with the physicality required to do the stuff he does, because that's the other thing that sets this movie apart. The stunts, like the practical stunts are amazing. But it's hard to imagine anybody else carrying both sides of this. Like Arnold in this stage could have done the physicality, probably not as well, honestly. Yeah. Like he's never been nimble. He's always just been big. This specimen, this like mountain dude that's doing stuff. Whereas Stallone's doing all this rolling around and jumping over stuff and kind of acrobatic things. But in terms of like acting, oh my God, especially in this era, he was leaving Arnold in the dirt, the dust. So
yeah, for sure.
Before we actually spoil the whole movie, I know this is an old film. This is back in 82. It's coming on 40 years old. I imagine there's a lot of people that weren't even born, probably have not seen this, or might be like us dismissing it based on the popular culture that's built up around Rambo.
Yeah.
But this movie is about, you know, this guy, John Rambo, who's about 8 years out of the Vietnam War, and he's a homeless vet in America. All of his Special Forces Green Beret squad did not make it out of Vietnam except for one. And we join him trying to track him down. And we find out that fella, too, succumbed to cancer based on his exposure to various chemicals in the war. And as he's processing that, he's walking through the small town that this guy hails from, Hope, Washington, set in the Pacific Northwest, which is a great location for this film.
Yeah.
He's picked up by a local sheriff who doesn't like the look of this vagrant walking through his town. And, you know, there's a scuffle that ensues. Rambo's picked up for vagrancy and resisting arrest. And in the process of processing him, a couple of sadistic deputies push him too far. He busts out of jail, escapes through the woods, and it becomes a vendetta between the sheriff, who has to take this guy in to prove himself right, and John Rambo, who will not be tamed by the likes of him. And again, I cannot stress, like, even though I've seen this film probably 6 or 7 times, like it'd been a while. And I didn't remember exactly all the action beats, and it's just it gets less riveting in the second half because the action scale intensifies, but the like it's all like mano a mano with him and Dennehy.
Mm-hmm.
But it leads to a very satisfying emotional climax. And yeah, yeah, watch it. Watch it. If you only watch one classic 80s action movie, please make it Rambo.
Yeah.
Well, before we get into our full spoiler thoughts about the movie, let's take a little break. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Okay, this film probably works better than it has any right to be. Let's talk about why. I mean, we've kind of already talked about a lot of the reasons why, but I want to talk about first thing that stands out to me is the stunt work. How it's all very grounded and plausible and overall, above all else, real. Like, there are not fast cuts. There are not CGI. There is not people painting faces over with green screen. It's two great car chases. I say car chases, although they involve an Enduro Max bike and one like a deuce and truck, a half military truck. Yeah.
I mean, this is back in the era where you're not going to get green screen, right? 82, they didn't have that technology. So I guess they did. Star Wars did it, but like, you're not getting it in a $14 million Rambo film.
Yeah. And like, you know, when you see a guy, like, there's just so many great scenes. Like, him busting out of jail is, first of all, they keep building the tension, because I kept on thinking when I was, it's been a while and I couldn't remember exactly when he breaks. And I kept on thinking, like, oh, when Dennehy grabs him and throws him against a car. Oh, surely when they're booking him here. Oh, when they're fingerprinting him. Oh, yeah. when they hit him with a nightstick in the back. But it's the detention. Like, you know, even if you know, like, I knew who Rambo was when I first watched this film. And I was like, well, he's not going to put up with this shit. Like, I was actually kind of amazed. So, like, by the time he breaks loose, you'll want to see him go on a tear.
Yeah.
but he's also really restrained. I mean, he's doing just enough that he needs to get out of there and get to some place where he feels safe.
Yeah. So that's one of the things, I guess, that Stallone did when he got a hold of this script. He read it, he liked it, but he did some rewrites to it. And one of those things that he set out to do was make John Rambo more sympathetic. And I don't know exactly where that comes in here, but I feel that in the movie, like from the jump, when he's simply walking down the road and now he gets hassled by this cop, I'm already on his side, right? So that part of it really works, because through the whole movie, I'm thinking, well, the only guy I really don't want to see die here, the only two, I guess, are like John Rambo and maybe Mitch, David Caruso's character, because he seems all right if he was left to his own devices.
But kind of complicit because of the system that he's joined up with here.
Right.
But I just, it's so good. And I like that, because like, I guess in the book, Rambo is more of just like a more of a monster.
Okay.
Like there is no restraint. There's no control. He kills people because, you know, for, I think, justifiable reasons, or like you can understand why. But it's, you know, it's hard, even, you know, as jaded as we are today, it's really hard to watch a person just mow down, you know, peace officers, right?
Sure.
You have to make him pretty fucking evil. And I think one of these guys, especially, I forget his name, the only death in the film, but like, and again, in Disney fashion, he dies of a fall from a great height due to his own stupidity and arrogance and bloodlust more than anything that Rambo does.
Gotta hate that guy so much.
It's smart. Oh yeah, he's such a dick.
Yeah,
and that's why I'm saying the soundtrack, I think, is really good, because in the tense lead up to these things, they got that kind of motif, that dun 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 dun. But also in the quiet parts where he's reflecting or being traumatized, it's got this kind of like sad, you know, emotional score that supports everything it has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there's especially, there's a, like a Rambo triumph that plays like once or twice. Like one time is when his deuce and a half bust through the police barricade. And it looks like he's like, maybe gets to apparent freedom. That also, like, you know, there's a couple of moments of soaring triumph that I enjoyed.
You
talked about your favorite stunt sequence being the stuff in the woods.
Oh, yeah.
Talk a little about that, because I thought, like, you know, I'm in a bit of a bushcraft kick right now. I enjoyed seeing this guy just like living off the land, roughing it.
I thought you might, you know. Yeah,
yeah, I really like, I don't know if I'll ever build a man trap out of sticks and stones, but like it works really well.
Yeah. And everything there works really well for me. The lead up to it, the chase where, you know, he's on this bike and you see this cop who clearly has no business going the places he's going in this car, trying to follow Rambo on the bike. But, you know, he chases him anyway because he's got that like bug up his ass where he won't be proven wrong. And there are some really cool stunts there. I love some of the things they do to hide the stuntman's face, because it's clearly not Sylvester Stallone riding this bike. But they have a scene where the bike rides right at the camera. And
dude,
and the guy isn't, like, Rambo's not wearing a helmet, so you can't really hide his face with a helmet. So what do? The dude does a wheelie to get the front of the bike up in front of his face going uphill. It's just such a badass stunt. Like, I have to imagine they approached this stuntman and were like, well, can you do anything here? Can you help us out? And he's like, oh, yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, like you got to ride right past the camera. It's going to be obvious you're not sly. What can you do? Hey, can I get the I'll just get the front wheel and I'll turn it slightly so it perfectly eclipses my head.
No problem.
You just see the Rambo wig around the wheel and I'll pop it right when the camera resolution will he's like looking over his shoulder. So you can't tell. And just as he's turning around, he rides the wheelie past the camera. I slow clapped when I saw that.
Yeah,
because this is dude. First time I've watched this as like my half-assed critic capacity, and I'm like, fucking A, because that's the thing about old action films is like the stunt doubles, you can just tell.
Yeah, all the time, yeah.
You can tell they're wearing padding under their flannel. You can tell they're just a dude in the wig. You know, they didn't even like really too much with like hair and makeup to make a match. But this was really incredible.
Yeah, that's some great stunt, man. And then, you know, once they get into the woods and Dennehy and his crew of like five cops or whatever are hunting him, that stuff is really cool. And they leave it mysterious, right? Like Rambo is kind of moving outside of the scope of the camera. So even you as an audience member don't quite know where he's going to be. And they do this sort of camouflage, depth of field stuff where you can't quite tell what's going on in the background until somebody walks by and then they focus in and Rambo jumps down out of a tree, right? And he's always been there. You just didn't notice it before.
It's very much like the Christian Bale Batman where he's just exploding out of nooks and crannies, like dropping out of a tree, blood coming out of like a rotten bank of leaves.
Coming out of a river.
Also, the violence isn't really exploitative because I think that would feel gross in the context of this. Yeah. It's wild how like sensitive this movie was in 1982 about PTSD. But like, it still is like I was on edge because it's not like in Predator where you see men gutted and spinal cords pulled out and like our limbs blown out. But like when that dude took the little spike trap to the leg, it's even though it's not sensationalized gore, the anguish on the character's face and like the performance, like when David Caruso takes that knife to the thigh, they cut away before you even see it. But you just hear him screaming like a stuck pig. No pun intended. And it like it really is like visceral, you know, and like when Rambo's hanging off by his fingernails on his edge of the cliff by this crazy cop. I mean, I'm just thinking of that stunt. Like you got a guy on a cliff. He's got to have wires. You got to be painting him out. You got this helicopter doing heroic pilots in this ravine and you got wide shots. So you see they're not faking anything. It's just genuinely exciting to the point where like the one probably most unbelievable stunt in the whole movie where he desperation throws himself off a cliff and just bounces off. It's just on the edge of believability. And he did like, I guess Stallone, the last third of the tree fell, did that stunt himself and broke a rib doing it. Really sells the action. It's like, okay, that's kind of like when Omar jumps out of the fourth window, the story window of an apartment complex at towards the tail end of The Wire. It's like, you think that a man can't do that. And then you read like, oh, actually, that's based on the real Omar. He actually did do that. And sometimes it's just, I don't know. It worked. Like any skepticism is kind of blown away by what you've seen Stallone already do in very close shots where he's clearly doing his own stunts.
Everything there is done so quickly, too. It's like he lures them into this trap that he's had a little bit of time to set up. But you get the like, you know, he put this together very quickly. And also when it goes down fast, right? Like,
yes,
you've got six guys here and he like they send the dogs in after him or whatever. He takes them out and then he leads them down this primrose path to his planned traps. Where he, in a matter of like 2 minutes of screen time, he takes down six dudes. It really paints a picture of a guy who, as Troutman later says, you know, is this force to be reckoned with.
Yeah. And I kind of think those, like, I like when you see the illustration between people that are professional killers and people who are just like amateurs. They talk about this in like The Expanse whenever Amos is talking about. You know, he always defers to Bobby because he's like, you know, I'm just like an amateur at this. She's like a real trained killer. And like one of my favorite books, Clancy books, is Clear and Present Danger, where, among other things, a group of commandos is in South America fucking around with cartel. But there's six of them left and they're facing off 200 like cartel soldiers with AK-47s and everything. And you'd think they're fucked, right? Well, these are six special forces dudes that can they just see things differently, like terrain. They know psychologically, like if we kill a couple of these dudes, they're going to be so pissed and angry that they're going to charge ahead into this withering crossfire that we've got set up. Yeah. And it kind of shows like these guys are just, you know, they got six dudes, they're all hunting right. They're joking about, hey, we hunted deer up here last year. We know this and, you know, we know this area and he don't. And this is going to be like a fun time. 10 minutes later, they're singing a whole different tune.
Yeah.
He's just a professional and they don't know what the hell they're doing. They're not dealing, haven't dealt with anything but a drunk and a vagrant in years. So
that's the thing that kills me is Brian Dennehy's character, Will Teasel or something like that. Never actually changes his tune throughout this whole movie. Right. There's no lesson that he learns. There's no respect that he comes to for Rambo and either his skills or what he's been through. I do wish there was something a little bit more there, because like as soon as so they blow up this mine and they think Rambo's dead inside, and they're trying to uncover it. Turns out Rambo's not dead. He comes out the other side of this mine and they find out. Right. And this guy, in the meantime, has sat down with Troutman and had this apologetic scene where he's talking about, you know, he wanted to kill him and he feels bad about that now. And he's not sure, like, if he even would have killed him, though. Now he doesn't need to worry about that because Rambo's dead. He'll never be confronted with that decision. And then he's immediately confronted with the idea that Rambo's still alive. And he goes right back into that mode where he's like, well, fuck it, I'm the sheriff and he did everything wrong and he's got to be punished. There's never any reckoning for that character.
Yeah. And I want to talk about a missed opportunity, I think, in the script to help, because as it is, like, there's not much redeeming in the police department other than Caruso's kind of reticence about, like, geez, can't you see this guy's crazy? We're treating this guy. This guy's a hero, a war vet, all like, why are we doing this? The other thing, I don't know how much to say about the tail end of the movie. It's all cool. Like, he blows up a gas station and a gun store with like piles of black powder and it's all kind of plausible. And he just destroys a police station with a machine gun.
Yeah.
But it's bigger and kind of dumber and not as tense. Like, you don't have those, like, you know, it's Batman slugging it out with Superman in his power suit. It's not the Batman taking down street level thugs like a phantom from a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing, like, there's a couple other things I thought was really cool. Like, when he falls out of the tree, he's got this pretty nasty cut on his arm. I don't know how they did it, but that's such a, it's like, it's this realistically pulsing blood wound that he's stitching up. It looks like, I would swear that he's just stitching up a real wound of himself.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look like a fake arm. Like, there's clearly some piping and tubing. It just looks amazing. Also, this knife is... When I was growing up, these Rambo knives, the hollow knife, you had a compass, you unscrew, and it's got fishing line and fishing hooks and a razor blade and maybe, yeah, I don't know, a rubber hose for a tourniquet. Like, it's like, my cousin had one of these things. You cut like 2-inch limbs off. I wanted one so bad, and my mom's like, you'll kill yourself with it.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I still think it's super iconic, and I guess like this single-handedly revitalized the knife industry in America.
So I hear.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This made all your pawn shops and your mall ninja and, you know, the dudes running the stuff in the corner of the gun shows. This was what put them on the map, and they're still eating out. They're still eating out on it 40 years later.
It was a super popular movie. It was number one in the box office for multiple weeks. It made 10 times its budget practically. It was like $14 million budget, $125 million box office. So.
Wow.
A lot of people saw this movie and a lot of people, I think, really liked this movie, although I don't know that critics really did very much.
Well, it's one of those films where, like, I think critically, Ebert gave it 3 stars, which is fair for what the criticisms he had of it. But I think that this was not appreciated in its time because it came out so close to Vietnam era. And it's been like, I think people weren't really ready to confront, like, fully that whole legacy. Shit, still, I don't know that we're ready to confront that whole legacy in an honest way. But I don't know. Like, it seems like it was mixed reviews at its time, but like, it's sitting like an 87% fresh and Rotten Tomatoes now. Do you have anything to say about the stunt work in particular, or do we want to move on to talking about I want to talk about Rambo the character and Sly Stallone playing him.
It might be the case, I'm not sure, because I looked at some of the names at the end credits of the stunt people that were working on this, and at least one of them matched a name, a last name that Troutman shouts out when he's talking about, when he's trying to communicate with Rambo and he's in the cave and he's like, oh, you know, listing the people in his company or whatever. I wonder if all of those stuntmen were names that were listed in that roster.
I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that all of the National Guardsmen who were just extras, their on-screen names were their real life names.
Oh, okay.
Like, when they're shouting, cool, Bobby, you got to do that, I ain't going in there. Like, that's like, that guy's name's Robert. So,
yeah.
One of the reasons this thing works is, especially, you know, 40 years on, like, Vietnam vets are increasingly kind of seen as sympathetic people. We feel kind of collectively bad about how certain aspects of our culture treated the soldiers. I'm reminded of the late Michael Brooks's adage to be ruthless with systems but kind to individuals. Okay. If you want to criticize the Vietnam War, fair enough. I've got plenty to criticize, but you see Born on the 4th of July and things like that, and you realize that a lot of people got into this with the best of intentions. And especially or here's another thing, got drafted without any fucking say in the world. Some of the poorest, most disadvantaged of us, and sent over to a country halfway around the world. And these people are spit on and called baby killers. And it's just very sympathetic. It's very sympathetic. So you feel bad for Rambo just when you think that he's like a homeless kind of like vet. And then he gets his comeuppance and his like kind of revenge on these small minded people. It all works very well, especially since, again, there's so much restraint. Like, there's this midpoint in the movie where, Rambo has disabled all of his deputies non-lethally. And then he comes for Dennehy. He's got the knife right at his throat. And he's like, I could have killed all of these, all your men, and I could have killed you. In town, you're the law. Out here, it's me. Let this go. Pleading, like, come on, like, I don't make me kill you fuckers. And that stuff is just all works. And it leads up to his speech at the end, where all this stuff pulls out and like the stuff that's really poignant. And he's like, over there, I could fly a gunship. I could drive a tank. I was trusted with $1 million equipment. Here, I can't hold a job for 2 weeks parking cars.
Yeah.
And when I was reading some retrospective threads of people discussing this movie, like, this line really resonated with a lot of vets. Like, there was a guy on Reddit said that he was an engineer on a aircraft carrier working like all this a nuclear reactor, spinning the screws on one of those powerful warships and he got out of service and he spent 18 months stocking shelves at Target trying to find a job. And like, how crazy and insulting. I saw other people like tank drivers and other like, radar technicians having the same like that really speaks to them. The fact that like you're highly trained and very intelligent. And yet, especially for Vietnam era vets, like you had a buddy got exploded to you at a bar in Saigon and you wake up screaming every other night and you have a hard time. The other thing that's poignant is like, sometimes I go for days, weeks without even speaking to anyone because how do I even, Like, what do we do with these warriors once we're done with them?
Yeah. I think. So there are two alternate endings to this movie. I don't know if it's in the alternate ending or if it's in the real ending now, because I watched them both. But he tells Troutman like, hey, you made me what I am. In one of those. And that's the thing that always comes back to me when I'm watching a movie like this, about this subject, about especially Vietnam era vets, but vets in general, like we're turning them into what we need them to be to do the job they do over there. But then we are not giving them, we are not then turning them back into something we want them to be in society. Or if we, barring the ability to do that, we are not giving them the support they need. It's kind of crazy to me how little support they get when they come back. We've got programs for like, you can buy a house cheaper or whatever. Is that really what they need when they come back? Or do they need a lot of help readjusting to the society that they don't recognize anymore?
And some like vets had it easier, when you come home from World War II and you're lauded as heroes and like the whole nation is behind you. And, you're getting free college and you've got all these fraternities that you can join after the war. But guys like Rambo, who... Yeah. His whole company gets wiped out. And that's one of the other thing after he talks about, I can't even hold a job parking cars, but he talks about, I don't have any friends. All my friends were over there and we're always talking about going to Vegas and driving in my buddy's 58 convertible. And we're going to cruise till the wheels fell off. And it's like, he almost reverts back to like the high school kid he probably was when he went into Vietnam. Yeah. And he's just crying about like, you could tell that's the thing that got them through. Like, man, when we get done, we're going to go back home and we're going to cruise and we're going to forget about all this stuff. And now everyone's dead and it's left for him to remember. And there's no good times. There's no job prospects. There's no romance. There's just thoughts of cleaning body parts of his dead bodies from some VK kid coming in there and suiciding himself with a shine box. It's like fucked up. And again, I think Sly almost uniquely can play that poor kid from a disadvantaged inner city that was shipped over there and like taken advantage. Like, obviously, they figured out what they got there and they put him in special forces and trained him, and he could do anything. He could do anything given a chance, but he can't. There's a book, Iron John by Robert Bly, and he talks, I don't know how much this stuff is true, but it resonated with me, that like other cultures, like Vikings, had these berserkers that they would get like drunk and like riled up and put two axes in their arms and just send on to the enemies. And like they would go like essentially achieve some kind of battlefield insanity where all they did is like want to, you know, rip and tear kind of. And but they all, and there's like whole ceremonies and rituals about getting yourself geared up to that. But then there was also a whole process when the battle was over to like take these guys away to kind of like recondition them to be back in the village. So they're not just like, you know, wanting to bathe in blood and rip and tear all the time. And I do feel like, you know, with the chronic underfunding, the VA and what we hear about, like, you know, I mean, it's, I know it varies city to city and place to place, but like,
sure.
I think it's not controversial to say we don't do enough to help vets with PTSD.
Do we really need them coming back and having to find a job pumping gas, having to find a job at Target stocking the shelves? Why don't we support them for the time it takes for them to reintegrate?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like, as especially since we're getting better and better at saving their physical bodies, like, you know, people are surviving wounds that would have been, they'd just been dead. They'd have been Arlington. Now they've got, you know, they're alive, but they missing an eye and two legs. Like, and yeah, they're going to be a Walmart greeter? What the fuck? Anyway, I just like that Sly is this unique, like, this character, Medal of Honor winner. And, you know, it's like the Vietnam, whatever you feel, but like he served his country to the best of his ability, did all the thing he's told to do, was told what he's doing was good for the country, was his duty. Mm-hmm. And then he gets back and civilians are spitting on him. He can't, you know, properly feed or care for himself. So he's smelling, he's homeless, he's a vagrant. It's just sad. This movie is a tragedy more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I think this movie, because I want to shift away from him to Brian Dennehy as Sheriff Teasel.
Yeah.
And I guess the police in general. The one thing from the book that I think made a lot of sense and resonates with me after I watched Born on the 4th of July is they established in the book that this guy is kind of a badass himself. He was a Marine commander in the Korean War.
Okay.
And one of the things I've got the impression is a lot of World War II and Korean era vets were not necessarily approving of the Vietnam era veterans, you know, because there's this reputation for them to being undisciplined and smoking dope and committing atrocities and all that kind of stuff. But that was more of a political and media driven thing than it was like, you know, Korea versus Vietnam, you know, in terms of intervention. And he had this personal grudge. You know, when this stinky guy wearing a service uniform with a tattered, dirty flag, long hippie hair, you know, he walks into this town. It's not just like, oh, this is a veteran. I should be. It's more of like, oh, it's one of those Vietnam. It's this one, those long haired, dope smoking, undisciplined, gave all of us veterans a bad name, you know, testifying in Congress that then throwing away their medals. John, all, like there is this. It wasn't just in being cruel for cruel sake. It's more of like just a generational kind of disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of hints of that that I was looking for, like in his office in the sheriff department, there's a Purple Heart. Like this guy's a decorated war kind of war hero, too. And I wish they could have, like, you know, this movie's a trim 90 minutes. I think a couple minutes of him, like David Caruso, like, why you got the heart on for this guy? Let me tell you about these sons of bitches and how they've disgraced, like, a little something, because as it is, it's like almost insane how what a bug up his ass he's got about Rambo.
Yeah. And you can't tell, like, you don't get any of that. Like, oh, this is probably a generational veteran kind of thing. You just get like, this is a cop who doesn't like vagrants. That's the flavor I get from that character.
Yeah. Rambo's like, why are you pushing me?
Yeah,
I know you guys. We don't like guys around like you drifters. You get one drifter, then 10 drifters, and now you got 20 drifters in your town. And, you know, fortunately, following that policy in America has led to the fact that there's no homeless people in America. You get a drifter in your town, mm-hmm. you drive them 30 miles across the bridge, you drop them off, and then they just wander off
forever.
Yeah, they just evaporate into the ether.
Sure.
And now there's no homeless people in America. It's amazing. But yeah, I wish there was something else.
I do too. Yeah. He's got this other speech that, I'm not sure how much the movie wants this speech to be the thing that kind of defines his reasons for attacking Rambo. But like, he talks about how, you know, when people have a complaint and that they're being mistreated, they need to come to me. They need to come up the chain of command. Right. And I'll deal with it. Because if people just start dealing with it themselves, all hell breaks loose. And I think the movie is trying to sympathize him a little bit there, because I don't think that's entirely untrue. My question is, what happens when someone comes to you with a valid complaint and you do nothing? What is the recourse? Because that is what is happening in this movie. John Rambo says, like, why are you doing this? You know, why are you pushing me? And he doesn't have a reason. He just does it because he's an asshole, apparently.
Yeah.
So, yeah, at that point, you know, all hell has broken loose. And unfortunately, you're on the wrong end of John Rambo.
And like, you know, the other thing is like, I feel like you're supposed to understand that he's bullshitting.
Mm-hmm.
Like the state cop is kind of like, which maybe is a rung above the professionalism of the small town jerkwater USA town, is like, you know, when he hears about the way they treated this prisoner. It's kind of like raising eyebrows. It's like, oh, that's all bullshit. And if one of my deputies got out of hand, I'd have kicked his ass. But then in the scene before, you hear about him talking about like they were best friends and they grew up together and they got each other's back. There's no way this Galt guy is this big an asshole in town and he doesn't know it and he's never kicked his ass. So it's like it's all hollow and bullshit. And this is the Galt guy, man. He's the one that I wanted to get dead most of all. And it was so satisfying. His own stupidity and bloodlust and arrogance did him in. I felt bad for the helicopter pilot too, because like he's like, this is dangerous. I don't want to be here. I hear your boss on the thing screaming for you not to shoot this guy, and he's like, if you don't stay here and hold this bird steady, I'm gonna kill you. And like, fuck, I guess like you'd believe him, because what's going to stop him? He's trying to kill this dude against orders,
right? You know, maybe he has an accident. Maybe the helicopter goes sideways thanks to the thermal for a second, and this guy just falls out, you know?
Who knows? I also have, this has nothing to do with anything, but I found in research this amazing story. So Patton Oswalt told this in an interview about Brian Dennehy. So Patton Oswalt is like getting a start, and he's at like one of his first after parties or rap parties, and there's a buffet. And he's going back for seconds, but he's standing there kind of like torn because he's feeling, because I guess his agent has told him like, hey, you should lose some weight, you get some better roles. And he really wants to, because, you know, Patton, like me, he's kind of a big boy. And as he's going through his moment of pathos, like Brian Dennehy comes up behind him, claps a big, you know, boulder sized hand on his shoulder and says, character actors, huh? Who gives a fuck if we're fat? And just goes plows in for thirds.
Nice.
I love that story. He decides like an archangel for fat kids. Brian did it. He came up from behind. it's amazing. I loved it.
He's great in this movie, Brian Dennehy. I hate his character so much, but the actor is good.
He's really good, especially when you think of like, I guess, people that passed on this role.
Kirk Douglas was one of them.
The one that really raised my eyes, I think, would have been like, man, what if that had happened? God damn it. Who's Tom Hagen in The Godfather?
Robert Duvall,
because he's got that kind of hard ass gear that he can play, and he might have been able to out Dennehy, but Dennehy's perfect, I think.
He's great, yeah.
The other thing that I think makes this work, this like triangle relationship between the antagonist, the protagonist, and Colonel Troutman. So like this guy, and I guess he came in because the guy that was supposed to do this, was it Kirk Douglas?
Troutman? Oh, yeah, he was going to be Troutman. Yes, yes.
Yeah,
Kirk and Douglas then he quit because he had some disagreements on the script.
Yeah, he wanted to do something at the end of the script. He walked off like 2 days before shooting to get this guy in. And I guess they're having to like read him his lines for his takes because he didn't have the script memorized.
Wow.
But this guy is like punching way above his weight in this movie. And he's got some killer lines like Dennehy is bitching about like, why did God make a man like Rambo? And he smash cuts to him. God didn't make Rambo. I did. And yeah.
Him telling the cops how fucked they are is some of my favorite stuff. It's cheesier than this movie probably should have gone if it wanted to stay serious. But lines like where Dennehy's, I don't know, saying something about how they're going to get Rambo. And he's like, well, that's like bringing the pigeons to the cat. It's so good.
And it's like, yeah, so what do you think that your boy's got a chance but with 200 guys with machine guns and however many dogs and three helicopters? And he's like, well, if you go up there with that many people, just make sure you bring a lot of body bags. Because, like, yeah, I'm not saying you can't take down Rambo, but he's going to kill like 30 of you in the process. And is that what you want to do? Also, like, you know, this guy's like ranting and raving, and Troutman looks at him and because he's like, oh, this guy's, you know, you can't just assault officers and be vagrant. And he's like, ah, vagrancy. It's going to look real good on his tombstone. Here lies the Medal of Honor winner, survivor of countless incursions against enemy lines, killed in Jerkwater, USA for vagrancy.
Jerkwater, USA is the best fake town name I've ever heard.
And even though he's got some cheesy lines, like that part where they're after in the bar, like after they think Rambo's killed and him and Dennehy, you know, Dennehy's trying to be magnanimous in victory. Right. And there's this point where he's like, well, what, you know, what would you have done if you would have, you know, met up with him? And he has this thing like he kind of like soberly considers it. And there's this long pause and he like summons up all this gravitas and says, I wouldn't know until I met him face to face. It's like I was like, man, this guy is like really, really good.
Yeah,
they really hit it. They got lucky that their last minute replacement was able to carry this stuff.
There's there's a bare sliver of daylight between this character in First Blood and this character in a Leslie Nielsen airplane movie. Like it's minute, it's tiny, and it barely hangs on this side of believability, but it worked for me.
Yeah, I was thinking the Colonel from MacGruber is the same way. Like it's a parody. It's like, oh, this guy's gonna tear you multiple assholes and you won't even know. And like, but it works because we didn't know that this was a ridiculous thing that could be parodied if you push it a little bit too far. Now we do.
It's true.
Hot Shots and Naked Guns and MacGruber's and all that stuff. Some stuff that doesn't work.
Oh,
I mean, we can talk about stuff that works, too. Here's the one thing that stands out. The tunnel rat scene. And I don't mean like the flashback to Vietnam as an actual tunnel rat. I mean him going through tunnels and having an Indiana Jones amount of rats to deal with. The scene's fine. I don't know. Maybe this is like snakes with Indiana Jones, speaking of other larger than life heroes, and he just can't stand rats. But like Stallone plays him with like, I don't know, like a little bit of a housewife on a chair. Eek about these rats where I don't know. I guess maybe some guys are comfortable doing one thing, another, but like it was a weird moment. Like, I feel like cut that out and give Dennehy 2 minutes of ranting and raving about how Korean War vets were skipped over and no one paid them any attention. And these dirty Vietnam. That's the one scene that like, I would have cut that one still. Get it to 88 minutes.
Yeah, I would have cut that. I think a better scene there might have been for him to just have to go totally underwater to get through one of these passages and all of his torches get wet. He's unable to. He's taking a shot in the dark here, right? Where he's got to get through this, and maybe there's something on the other side that will lead him to salvation, but maybe not. That could have been cool.
I think that would have been. Did you have any others that you thought? Because that's like I said, that's the one, and it's such a minor. It's like a 30-second scene of him, like, oh God, the rats, no, they're in my hair.
that's not super egregious. The worst thing in this movie to me is that final song that plays over the credits. I think this is a god awful song. It's A Long Road, and it's a tonal clash with this nice emotional moment you saw at the end of this movie and the action that happened up until then. this is written by a guy who's like a Grammy winner who writes and performs. Writes and this stuff was for like well Celine thought Dion. Of.
Yeah, this Dude, was this is also used well thought of.
Kind of as a Rambo theme for the next for the sequels and for the animated series.
Yes, yeah.
This is a shitty song. This is a. I don't think Dan Hill, who actually performed this thing, is actually a very good singer. This music was written by Jerry Goldsmith, who I think should stick to music composition mm-hmm. for films, not hit songs. Mm-hmm. The lyrics were by a guy named Hal Shaper. I don't know anything about him, but the lyrics are terrible. Everything about this song is bad. Very bad.
100%.
And I cannot believe it stuck around for the rest of Rambo.
And it sucks because it almost ruined, like, if they had had just a normal classical theme for like 30 seconds into the credits and then they started this up, it'd be fine because I could stop it before. But it like starts several bars into the like where I should be sitting and thinking about, like, is this justice? Is this fair? Am I OK with how this works? Is Rambo OK? Like, what's going to happen? Like, as soon as I am doing that, the movie is poorly telling me what to think about it with it's a long road. Yeah, no, it sucks.
It was bad by 80s standards. It's god awful now.
Yeah, but people, like I said, it was pretty well regarded and sold well, and they used it like literally everywhere. So I don't know what to say about that. A couple final thoughts I had. What did you think of the? Because I know you've seen it. You alerted to. What did you think of the alternate ending of Rambo, which is more consistent with the plot at the end of the book? I guess in the end of the book, the John Rambo and the Brian Dennehy's character, Sheriff Jerkwater, are mutually wounded to the point of death, and Troutman comes in and mercy kills Rambo and then sits and spends his final moments with the other guy, Teasel, Sheriff Teasel.
Yeah.
And this, the alternate ending is Rambo begs Colonel Troutman to kill him, and he kind of refuses to do so, but then Rambo grabs the gun, like, you know, covers his hands with his, pulls it to his chest, and makes him fire, which kills him. What do you got any thoughts about which was superior to the other? Or?
I feel like I like the actual ending of the film better than the alternate. It's certainly more hopeful, which I like out of movies. Call me a sap, a sucker, whatever. I like that stuff. But it's not a super strong preference. I think either one works in this case.
Yeah, optimistic. Because I didn't feel optimistic at the end of this movie. Although I guess, like,
I mean, it's more optimistic than him being
could
dead.
Rambo beat the rap or the or like, so is the idea that Rambo is going to beat the rap? Because
no,
like,
I think it's just the idea that Rambo could have a life after this at some point.
But I feel like the life he's going to have is like reinducted in some kind of shadowy clandestine. It's like, we're going to take you and put you in Delta Force and we'll just throw you against the enemies of America clandestine until you die.
Oh, see, like, I think he's going to prison and he's going to come out at some point and hopefully have a decent life.
Yeah. And I was trying to think, as I was working on my notes, I was thinking, like, what would the likely outcome? Because he didn't actually kill anybody. The circumstances of the arrest were bullshit in the first place. He's very traumatized. He's a Medal of Honor winner. I don't know. I feel like he's still going to go away for a long time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he blew up a whole bunch of the town.
Yep. And they can sell him being a cop killer.
He's assaulted a lot of police officers.
Sure. So the other thing is, could I sell you on the idea that First Blood is a Christmas movie?
Probably not, but I'm really interested to hear why you think you could.
I didn't even think of this until the last act. There's a prominent giant Santa Claus drinking Coca-Cola billboard in the middle of town.
Yeah.
There's a Christmas tree in the police department as it's getting shot up and as Rambo's doing all of his pathos stuff. And it's set in obviously in the winter to snow underground. It's got to be it's a set in the December of 81. If we only had a Christmas song, I'll be
Jingle
home.
Bell
imagine
Rock.
They or replace the final bullshit long road with I'll be home for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had established that he was like hoping to make it to his buddy's house for Christmas because he doesn't have any family. He's desperate. And like, this would be, I would fight till my dying breath that this is a Christmas movie. As it is, I think, I think it's a little weak. Yeah,
it's certainly not a Christmas movie. Although there is that line where Rambo says, you know, if it wasn't for that bad Christmas present that I got last year, I wouldn't be doing any of this. Mm-hmm. There's that line. It's right near the beginning. It's quick. You might miss it.
Have you seen the last Rambo? Was that Rambo 6?
For Last Blood?
So yeah, last one was Last Blood. Okay. Yeah, did you ever see that?
No, I saw the remake. Well, the remake of Rambo. I want to talk about that in a second, but I saw Rambo, right?
Yeah, we both saw that. I remember thinking that was a pretty good action flick, but nothing like this.
No,
it wasn't like I was hoping it would be the Rocky Balboa. Mm-hmm. Like cap off to like, okay, this film series kind of lost its way, got way too in this 80s sequel action itis, but now we actually bring back to the core of what's good about the character and it's interesting about the character. But I don't know. I haven't heard anything about Last Blood. Can we talk about the way this movie series name is more fraught than like the Xbox? You got First Blood, Rambo 1,
First Blood.
Part 2.
No.
Yeah. Got First Blood, Rambo, First Blood, Part 2, Rambo 3, Rambo, then Rambo Last Blood.
It's messed up, man. I swear AVGN must have done a series on this. He does these like mixed up name franchises things where he just goes over the names of crazy things like Friday the 13th is really fucked up. Or I don't know. It's weird. This whole franchise is weird. Did you know there's a Bollywood remake of Rambo?
Dude, I just found out and it came out last year. I'm desperate to see it.
I saw the trailer and it looks nothing like First Blood. It looks far more like Rambo 3.
Right.
It's just this over the top action extravaganza.
That's Bollywood. I mean, it's tends to be a little over the top, but I really, really want to see it as soon as. But it's weird because it should have come out, but the Wikipedia article is still written in the future tense. And I don't know if it's because no one gives a fuck about coming back and editing the entry for the Bollywood thing for the Rambo remake, or
it could be coronavirus that, just postponed it. Right.
It could be. Yeah. But I thought the filming was like wrapped up in 2018 and it was going to be a 2019 or 2020 release. Maybe they pushed
the theaters closed down. Yeah.
I don't know what theater
life is like over in India, but
yeah. I would have actually looked up and see if it came out a little bit harder if I'd known that we would talk about it. But yeah, it's apparently filmed, so it'll come out eventually if it's not out already. I definitely want to see it. I want to add it to, because I've got the Rambo Complete Edition, I'm kind of obsessed with this movie now. There's I got this box set that has all the Rambos from First Blood all the way to not the Last Blood, but the one before that. And it's got a Sly Stallone commentary track for this film.
That's cool.
Like a making of featurette and so this other stuff that I didn't get a chance to watch because I just got this. I thought it was going to be a bare bones because it was one of those things where they got like 8 discs shoved into like a single DVD cover. And that, in my mind, it usually is just a shovel of the, I've got a bunch of those collections and they almost have or bare bones. But like these discs are kind of loaded. So like I kind of want to work my way through and see some of this because I had no idea how fraught the making of this film was, how many fits and starts it did, how like the disastrous first cut. The legend is that like I guess Stallone was like wanted to write this project off, but to get like international financing for distribution, they did a 40-minute like highlight reel, and like he was supposed to show up to kind of say some words afterwards, and he's like I guess he got bullied into it, or his agent said he had to, and he was sitting in the theater and he's watching, and he's like, holy shit, this 40 minutes is pretty hot. Mm-hmm. You know what? Just cut out all my bullshit, and this film's going to be good. If not for that, who knows what would happen. So
speaking of disc versions of this, I've got a 4K version of this that I watch with HDR and all that on my nice sound setup and everything. This movie looks really good. Like it's got the film grain, which you expect from that. But the restoration they did is really good, especially like the explosion scenes and the fire scenes, like when he's carrying a torch through the darkness of that cave. It's It looks really good in 4K.
Yeah, I noticed. I don't have the 4K. I've got the Blu-ray restoration is what this one is. And I noticed, gotcha, like when he had that like combat knife, he's using it as a torch, like stuck in, I could see like little drips of fire dribbling, yeah, down of. And the, like the color levels when he's in those, the not color, the light levels when he's in the tunnel,
uh-huh,
you know, a lot of, it's so good. Like the in the battle scenes in the town are so dark, but like you can clearly see everything that's going on. This movie's, yeah, amazingly well lit. Mm-hmm. And very atmospheric because it's very Pacific Northwest winter, cold and dreary and overcast. And everything's gray. There's no light, no that sunshine.
Reminds me. So this was filmed in British Columbia. And this is something I pulled out, right, of Wikipedia. It's not, my own research here. But like, I found out that they had to import all the weapons that they used on this movie into Canada, yeah, for filming because they just, mm-hmm, didn't have them or whatever up there. So they import
Canada's
a bunch of weapons.
Pop guns and squirt, you know, yeah.
Right. And they go on to start filming this movie, and then 50 of the weapons turn out missing during the filming of this movie.
Hey, Canadians desperate to get their hold on the boom boom.
That's wild.
I saw that too, and then I saw another article that talked about like what actually happened is that one of their big military trucks got stolen, and it happened to have it. Like the okay, headline is 50 weapons stolen off the set, but it's probably more like someone made off with this big military truck, and hey, as a bonus, it had 50 guns in the back. But,
yeah, it's like Fast still, and Furious. Yeah. Paul Walker, yeah, and Vin Diesel came up, stole a truck, and were like, "Hey, what's in this?"
No, they knew they were high. I don't know who. I can't think of any of the characters, the villains. I can't. You know what? I can think of action pieces in those movies, but I can't think of a single fucking like plot. You know.
what about living a quarter mile at a time? That's a plot.
Sure. That's a theme more, yeah, than like, yeah, in Corona and Family. Right. And that one time the Letty lost her mind and forgot who she was and was a villain. But yeah,
I mean, the villain of that first movie is Vin Diesel, right? Like that's the, yeah, guy that Paul Walker's trying to catch as the undercover cop.
But at one point, Rock was the villain too.
True,
and for
true,
sure, Transporter guy was the villain. And they're all like one big happy family now. So it's family over everything. There you go.
I know who the villain in First Blood is. It's Brian Dennehy's Teasel.
I will say that like this is a notch above a lot of these other 80s action films.
Oh,
one,
yeah,
of the mission objectives I have for 2021 is to bring some 80s action back into our coverage. It's hard, yeah, because that's like we're swimming in pulp in this era with unlimited, mm-hmm, Marvel and Disney Star Wars releases and The Walking Dead we're trying to catch up on. But like I would like to find a break where we can do like a half dozen of the great 80s films that we haven't so far covered.
Yeah,
hopefully we can get
we
that
need
on
to
the
get to
because,
Predator finally, because I found myself watching this movie and in those scenes in the woods going, I need to watch Predator again because I'm not sure it's much better than this. Honestly, this is so good.
I don't think Predator is a better movie. Like it's a better pure action film. It's one of the best
certainly
pure action films, but a better movie. No way. A silly movie, yeah, about an alien hunting dudes in the jungles of fucking Cambodia or whatever. It's South America. I think there's no way that's as good as this. Soldier coming home, getting spit on and shit on and
for sure
pushed beyond the breaking point.
Yeah, it's just these scenes in the woods. I'm like, man, did Predator really do much better action than this? Because this is kind of amazing.
It really is.
I need
especially
to see Predator,
since it's,
yeah,
it's just all so fucking real. I just watched it, yeah, like 6 months ago.
Nice.
I got the Blu-ray if you want to borrow it.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed our discussion of this 80s action film. Prestige action film. You will not be finding the rest of our 80s action film in the Prestige. Definitely look forward in the pulp section.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, can't wait to see you back here again. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.